Now I am the one making the decision. That's the title of the 7th Annual Policy Summit, sponsored by the Missouri End of Life Coalition on September 29th, 2011. Joining us now on the Bioethics Channel is one of the speakers for the program. His name is Charles Sabatino, and he is Director of the Commission on Law and Aging at the American Bar Association. Charlie, that title, "Now I Am the One Making the Decision," it sounds a bit ominous, but what it means is important, that many of us will be making decisions at the end of life, and we need to be prepared.
That's true. I think the real message there is that is the word prepared. If you don't think about this ahead of time, if you don't make some plans ahead of time, then the decisions tend to be made by default by somebody else because you get caught in the whirlwind of the medical system without a clear decision maker.
You are coming to Missouri to talk about a couple of issues that complicate this process. One is that Missouri is among a small minority of states where people are receiving non-emergency medical services without capacity to give informed consent. Talk about what that problem means.
But there's a lot of issues in Missouri. One of which has to do with who can make decisions for you if you can't make them for yourself. The other has to do with the developments around PULSE, or Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, which is a protocol states are picking up on. And there are a few barriers on both these counts that we hope to talk about at the program.
Are there states that serve as a best-case scenario, a model for Missouri and other states?
Well, for healthcare decision-making in general, as your audience probably knows, every state has one or more types of advanced directives that work in their state. But we also know that two-thirds of the adult population don't do advanced directives. And when a serious injury or illness arises where the patient can't make decisions for himself or herself, we tend to rely on family members. But in Missouri as well as Kansas, there is no automatic authority in the hands of your close family members, even your spouse, to step in and make decisions. And both the states are in the minority on that. There are about 40 states that have what I call default surrogate laws that put those decisions in the hands of close family members. That's a surprise to a lot of people when they discover that they don't automatically have that authority because generally people want somebody who's close to them to be holding the reins when they can't hold the reins themselves.
A number of years have now passed since the Terri Schiavo case burst onto the national scene. Are you finding that the environment in legislatures are welcoming or less than welcoming when it comes to proposed laws addressing these issues?
I find that state legislatures are more welcoming to it than the federal government is right now. As you recall, 2 years ago, during the health care reform debate, there was a little provision that got a lot of attention because it was mischaracterized as death panels for granny. And really all it was doing was suggesting that Medicare pays physicians for the time it takes to consult with families around advanced directives and advanced care planning. Here in Washington, where I am, I don't think Congress has gotten over that yet. They don't want to touch anything that speaks of end of life or advanced care planning at the moment. I don't find that same insensitivity in the states. By and large, states have been willing to revisit their laws. And over the last 15 years or so, we've actually seen states trying to simplify what has become an unnecessarily complicated area. Of law. That's one of the barriers why people don't do advanced directives, not the only one, but they find it as overly legalistic and they're not quite sure how you do it. And the point really is simply to communicate what your priorities are, what your values are. And it's not a legal task, but we've legalized it by creating legal tools to do it.
Another issue you're addressing at the Policy Summit in Missouri on September the 29th is PULSED, Physicians' Orders on Life-Sustaining Treatment. This approach seems to be gaining traction with 11 states using the forms and 15 others considering it. Explain PULSED and how it works.
Well, it's really evolved out of the recognition that even if you have done your advanced directive and a living will, even if you've been very specific about what you want or don't want down the road, the literature tells us that in most cases, those instructions don't really get in the medical record in an actionable form, and therefore they don't drive decisions. What drives medical decisions, particularly in a hospital setting, are medical orders. So there needed to be a translational tool to get your wishes communicated to the healthcare system and translated into the language that the healthcare system understands, which are medical orders. So that's basically what PULSED does. It requires that there be a conversation with the patient or the patient's representative at a time when they are very far along in their disease. PULSED is not for everybody. It's not for a healthy adult. It's for people who have an advanced illness that is going to not get better. It's progressive and going to get worse. And it requires the conversation about what your priorities are, what your values are, and based upon that, it prescribes a set of orders that address the high probability kind of emergencies that you can run into, namely if your heart stops or your breathing stops, or if you need artificial nutrition or hydration, or if an emergency arises and there's a question of whether you should be transported to the hospital. So there's four or five, or some states have six different decisions that they will spell out the set of doctor's orders on a visible standardized form that all providers will recognize. And that form follows you across care settings, so you don't run into the problem that we always have in our system, is once you go from one setting to another, all the information from where you were before doesn't get to the new place, the care plan is not communicated. PULSED is intended to communicate your wishes and make them actionable across care settings. And that's pretty revolutionary. That we've never been able to do that very well before. And the emerging literature on PULSED is giving us the evidence that it's doing a pretty good job of that.
Are there some states that do PULSED better than others? What seem to be the common denominators for states who do it well?
Well, those that have been doing it a long time have the benefit of experience, and every state that has been doing this every couple of years has somewhat revised the procedures in order to improve them. The original state that adopted this was the state of Oregon. They've been doing it for 20 years, and they are kind of looked at as the model. Other states that have been doing it a long time include West Virginia. California has been serious about it for the last couple years. They haven't been doing it a long time, but they've really put a lot of resources into rolling it out well. New York is in its, I think it's its second year now of a statewide implementation. Every state is a little bit different, and the even though the PULSED forms that are used, and I have to emphasize, it's not just a form, it's a whole process of communication and care planning and tracking that is represented by this PULSED form. And the PULSED form in every state will look sort of similar, but there'll be differences from state to state because the culture and the healthcare realities of every state tend to be a little bit different.
Charlie, it seems we're still struggling to reach just that right balance when it comes to delivering care to those who need it and those who want it at this very vulnerable stage. Are we getting any closer to achieving that right balance?
Well, I think we are, although it's going to be halting progress for a while to come. And it's not just the decision-making aspect of end-of-life care that is undergoing a lot of rethinking and scrutiny. It's the whole quality of care and what people want and what good care is for people who are in advanced stage of illness. We still have a very powerful tendency to throw people in the ICU as soon as a serious crisis comes up. And for many people, that's not really what they were wanting or planning on. Most people still don't know what palliative care is, and yet palliative care is one of the most, in a way, aggressive form of treatment for people who are fairly far along in an advanced illness. And it's not, you know, just comfort care. It really is addressing quality of life on many dimensions. And and more recent studies have shown some evidence that palliative care actually extends people's lives longer than does aggressive traditional care for lung cancer patients. A study that was published last year in the Journal of the American Medical Association was caught a lot of attention because of that very fact. It's not surprising in one sense, because the person whose comfort needs are taken care of very holistically may very well find it easier to get by for much longer time than somebody who's going through very torturous treatment in terms of chemotherapy and radiation therapy and the like. We'll probably see that investigations along those lines heat up quite a bit, because palliative care has gotten a lot of attention, and it deserves a lot of attention, but it is not the norm out there right now.
Charles Sabatino is director of the Commission on Law and Aging at the American Bar Association. He will speak at the 7th Annual Policy Summit, sponsored by the Missouri End of Life Coalition, on September 29th, 2011. For more information, visit mo-endoflife.org. That's mo-endoflife.org. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.